If violence continues, the only thing that we should do is to stamp out that violence through law enforcement actions.
Hong Kong ideologies continue to clash. It's Wednesday, August 28th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, fighting extremism online. Uyghurs gather in Washington. Teetering economic outlooks. Olympic competition may heat up. Artful glass. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said Tuesday she is open to dialogue with protesters, but that the government will not tolerate violence.
If violence continues, the only thing that we should do is to stamp out that violence through law enforcement actions. You would just imagine if under the pretext of communication or starting a dialogue, that we are not going to enforce the laws in Hong Kong, that we are going to tolerate all forms of violence and disruptions in Hong Kong. That will be the end of the rule of law in Hong Kong.
Police arrested more than 80 people during protests Saturday and Sunday that included clashes with officers. We spoke with one Hong Kong native who is now a professor of political science about Carrie Lam's comments. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Victoria Tinbor Hoi at the University of Notre Dame via Skype.
Now, this is not the first time that she said that, well, let's have a dialogue. Because in 2014, especially the students' leaders of the time, they actually sat down in the same room with Carrie Lam. And so the leaders of the time said, what happened to us afterwards? Most of us were locked up in jail. So nobody really trusts that she really has any sincerity in trying to have any negotiation. This is not to mention that she has been hiding behind the police, essentially using the police to fire directly at protesters and passersby and also journalists alike these days.
How much control do you think Beijing has over Carrie Lam?
This is I think that the best way to characterize this is when a Reuters reporter asked her at one of their press conferences, Chief Executive, do you have any autonomy to formally withdraw the bill? And she offered no answer. And at the same time, because she has been hiding behind the police, and so for her, it is almost basically it's not possible to open any independent investigation into police abuses. And of the five demands that the protesters have, these two, formally withdrawing the bill and opening independent investigation, these are the most important. And even her own allies, these business leaders, these notables that she met with a few days ago, all said that do these two things and you can de-escalate the situation. She apparently has no autonomy to do that.
She seems to be trying to separate and communicate with the segment of the protesters who she sees as being peaceful and separate out those of being violent. Is there such a separation, and can she do that, and should she do that?
So another thing that she's been saying is also that the news that's been coming out is she wants to impose, talking about imposing emergency on Hong Kong. Essentially, this is more or less like martial law. And she also, because she does not really have the autonomy to sacrifice the two of the most important demands. And therefore, because of that, the protesters are going to escalate. And the plan, it seems that she's just going to arrest everybody until all of those more forceful people are all arrested and put behind bars and also beaten to the point that they have bone fractures and brain bleeding and all with all these serious health issues. The problem is that it is not working. It has already backfired. So we can see that between the 1 million strong march and then 2 million strong march on two Sundays in June, and then also another 1.7 million strong march on August 18th, between those two marches, that there was escalation to more and more violent protest, and the hope of the plan of the government was okay. So let's just get all of these guys, lock them all up, except that Hong Kong people apparently, after a month and a half of escalated violence, they still came out and say that we are still behind the protest.
When you say we, who do you refer to?
I suppose Hong Kong people, because I've been watching this. I was born in Hong Kong. I grew up in Hong Kong. And I've been watching this in the U.S. And so this is like in a way that, you know, at the same time, I'm a political scientist. I want to be an independent observer. But, you know, when your house is burning, sometimes it is kind of difficult.
Is there a resolution to this?
The resolution is really easy. If the Carrie Lam would just listen to even, you know, the people that she is willing to reach out to, the people who normally are very pro-establishment, is really formally agree to withdraw the bill. If the bill is dead, why not just withdraw it? And if, you know, there's such huge demand for independent investigation into abuses, doesn't have to be just police abuses. It can be protesters turned to violence as well. People need to know the truth.
Do you see that as a possible outcome?
It's not very likely at this point, but then for the Hong Kong people, they could say that there's nowhere to retreat from, to retreat to, and so they are still hopeful.
The United States is calling for calm on all sides in Hong Kong. A senior State Department official told VOA on Tuesday, "We can't sit quiet for more violence." The official added no more violence on both sides, either from the police or from the protesters. Certainly not any large-scale response through violence. In Beijing, China voiced strong dissatisfaction Tuesday with a joint statement by G7 leaders calling for Hong Kong's autonomy in line with Britain's handover of control of the territory to Beijing in 1984. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang accused them of meddling and harboring evil intentions. At a news briefing, Geng said, "We have repeatedly stressed that Hong Kong's affairs are purely China's internal affairs and that no foreign government, organization, or individual has the right to intervene." We invite you to follow us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website, where you may read more on our top story. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. China accuses G7 of meddling in Hong Kong's affairs. United States wants to disrupt China's rare earth dominance. Pentagon accuses China of bullying tactics in waters off Vietnam. Investigative journalist pays the price for an exposé in India. The forgotten Rohingya stuck in limbo in Myanmar's prison-like camps. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia, also at the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The Internet has grown from not just a vehicle to innocently communicate and share a wealth of ideas, but a place where misinformation and hate can easily be spread to almost anywhere in the world. Australia is now planning to block access to websites hosting extremist material during terrorist attacks or other crises. The measures have been driven by the attacks on two mosques in Christchurch in March by a lone gunman who live-streamed his crimes, as we hear from Sydney, where Phil Mercer reports.
Australia says it wants to deny terrorists the opportunity to glorify their crimes online. There has been increased scrutiny of websites and social media since the live-streaming on Facebook of the mosque attacks in New Zealand in March. The alleged gunman, a 28-year-old Australian Brenton Tarrant, murdered 51 people and injured dozens more. A 17-minute video showed a lone gunman dressed in black shooting at worshippers and was widely circulated online. Possession of the footage has been banned in New Zealand. Tarrant has denied charges of murder, attempted murder, and a terrorism offence. In response to the massacre, a 24/7 crisis coordination centre will be set up in Australia to scour the internet in real time for extremely violent or terrorist material. Australia's Minister for Cybersecurity, Paul Fletcher, says should a Christchurch-style attack happen again, authorities will be ready to block offensive content.
The Australian government will respond should a similar episode occur in the future and there be similarly abhorrent violent material and extreme terrorist content accessible on the internet. In addition, the Australian government's crisis coordination centre will be monitoring for the prevalence of such material.
There will also be restrictions on domains showing murder, rape or torture. There could also be new laws to force digital platforms to improve online safety standards. Tech companies, including Microsoft, YouTube and Twitter, are expected to tell the Australian government by the end of next month how they intend to carry out the recommendations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam says she's open to dialogue with protesters, but the government will not tolerate violence. In a rare public comment, she said it would be inappropriate for the government to accept the demands of protesters who resort to violence and harassment. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. UN officials and human rights advocates say China is continuing to step up its persecution of ethnic Uyghurs, confining as many as 1 million members of the largely Muslim ethnic group in conditions that observers describe as similar to concentration camps. Many of those who have fled the repression have made their home in the Washington, D.C. area, where Aya Sadek tells us is now home to the largest community of Uyghurs in the United States.
This park in the Washington suburb of Fairfax, Virginia, is about as far as it could be from the terror experienced by the parents of these children in their native Xinjiang province. Here, they play and speak the Uyghur language freely, something they are not allowed to do in their homeland. Irade Kashgari co-founded Anna Karen Education, a Uyghur language school in Northern Virginia.
I'm happy that I have this freedom and this capability to speak up for my family and for the Uyghurs, but at the same time, there's always feeling like that something's missing, right? When you don't have that access to your identity, to your homeland, you don't feel completely full.
For 18-year-old Uyghur-American activist Eric Jalil and the other children who fled to safety in America, the homeland is but a distant dream.
My biggest disappointment is I won't be able to go back. I mean, it's where I'm from. I always wanted to see where my parents grew up. They always described how it was a beautiful place.
Human rights activist Omar Kanat fears there may be nothing to return to if China continues its colonization campaign.
The situation described by the Western experts as a cultural genocide, a ethnic cleansing, and a crime against humanity. That's what's happening in the region against the Uyghur people.
America has offered Uyghurs safe refuge, and U.S. lawmakers have provided words of support, with a bill condemning human rights violations in Xinjiang.
About 3 million in education camps. What? And why is the world not speaking out? We have to.
China's suppression of religious faith and religious communities is real. It is evil. It is too horrendous to ignore.
But so far, their words have yet to lead to action.
The U.S. can't do too much because they have to keep their relations with China. But obviously, I would like more support from the U.S.
Even as they enjoy peace in their new home, many Uyghurs say their hearts still ache as they wonder if they will ever see their homeland again. Aya Sadek, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, growing economic concerns. You're listening to VOA Asia.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. More than 1,000 students have rallied in the capital of Pakistan-held Kashmir to denounce India's downgrading of the special status of the portion of the disputed region it controls. The demonstrators chanted, "We want freedom," and denounced human rights violations in Indian-administered Kashmir. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the U.S. economy may soon slide, as some economists say will be the eventual result of the trade war with China. And Israel finds an East Asian business partner, as we hear in today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
A majority of U.S. business economists predict that the U.S. economy will go into a recession by the end of 2021. Ken Simonson is a survey analyst for the National Association for Business Economists.
There were several things that indicate concern about policy and global economic conditions. Specifically, that trade policy does seem to be having negative effects for many U.S. businesses, that the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has had a net negative impact on housing in this country. There's also an expectation that global economic growth will slow from 3.6% last year down to 3.25% or less. And finally, that Britain is likely to go through a no-deal exit from the European Union, and that that could also have negative consequences for the U.S. as well as the U.K. and the rest of Europe.
5% of economists surveyed predicted a comprehensive trade deal between China and the U.S. would result. 64% suggested a superficial agreement was possible, and nearly 25% expect nothing to be agreed on. Trump has dismissed concerns about a recession, offering an optimistic outlook for the economy after recent drops in financial markets. But he continues to push the Federal Reserve to drop interest rates further, signaling a need to stimulate the economy. Despite the skepticism, at least for now, most economic signs appear solid. Employers are adding jobs at a steady pace, the unemployment rate remains near a 50-year low, and consumers are optimistic. Israel and South Korea have signed a new trade agreement that will eliminate tariffs on a range of goods. Under the deal, 95% of Israeli exports will be exempt from customs, and imports from South Korea, including cars, auto parts, toys, and appliances, will also be duty-free. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We've had free trade agreements in other parts of the world, with the United States, with Europe, and elsewhere, but this is the first free trade agreement we have with an Asian economy, and what an economy.
The agreement comes after 3 years of trade negotiations between the two countries. Israeli-South Korea trade stood at $2.5 billion last year, and Netanyahu says this agreement will double the trade volume between the countries. The trade agreement still needs to be ratified by parliaments in both countries, which will take approximately 1 year. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Australia says a Chinese-born Australian writer held in China since January has been formally arrested on suspicion of espionage amid growing tension between Canberra and its largest trading partner. Espionage is punishable by death in China. There was no immediate response from China's foreign ministry. Find more on VOA Asia Facebook. Now in VOA Asia, the Tokyo Olympics are less than a year away, and excitement is growing in the Japanese capital, as ticket sales are extremely strong. But amid the anticipation of the global focus on Tokyo, are growing concerns that the heat and humidity at the Tokyo Olympics next summer may pose a danger to athletes. Earlier this month, a worker at an Olympic construction site in the city died from heat stroke. Across the country, a heat wave beginning late July killed at least 57 people. While weather and temperatures may or may not be the same as right now, organizers say they're being proactive by taking measures to combat potential hazards, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the Japanese capital.
Summer in Tokyo, with temperatures topping 35 degrees Celsius, clear skies, and humidity peaking above 80%. Conditions that pose a big danger at next year's Olympic Games, says George Havanith, an expert on the effects of temperature and climate on athletes.
When it gets warmer, of course, the skin gets warmer and doesn't lose that much heat to the environment, and the sweat evaporation still is then the main factor for cooling. Now, if we also push up the humidity as it would happen in Tokyo, That means that that sweat evaporation gets even more difficult. So it gets more and more difficult to lose the heat.
Heat stroke is a big danger, especially for endurance events.
About 15% of athletes, even in a cool environment, have body temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius. Now, if you push the temperature higher and the cooling gets more of an issue, we get more and more athletes in that whole cohort going into these temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius, bringing them closer and closer to the level where we can expect an exertional heat stroke.
Tokyo hosted test events in recent weeks, including a mixed triathlon relay and a swimming marathon, among the endurance sports seen as posing some of the biggest dangers to athletes.
The sunlight was strong and the water temperature was high. When I joined the race, I worried I might suffer from heat stroke.
Games organizers have shifted the start times of several endurance events to begin early in the morning and say they are taking other measures to mitigate against the heat.
Such as increasing water supply points and cooling areas. I also hear they are deploying medical staff every 500 meters of the marathon course.
Havanith says additional measures may be needed.
Having ice baths available for the athletes to cool them down quickly if they have an exertional heat stroke is the advised method.
The last time Tokyo hosted the Olympics in 1964, the games were moved to October to avoid the summer heat. With a packed sports calendar and demands from global broadcasters, that's no longer possible. Scientists say it's vital athletes acclimatise themselves well in advance of the start of the Games in July 2020. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Tokyo.
Seattle is home to giant multinational companies such as Microsoft and Amazon. It has a lot of coffee and rain as well. But tucked away in the northwestern corner of the United States near Canada, it is also the home of glass art in the United States. Chihuly Glass Museum contains thousands of glass artworks by artist Dale Chihuly. Valja Baraputri from VOA's Indonesian service reports.
Right next to Seattle's iconic Space Needle is the Chihuly Garden and Glass Museum. Here in Seattle, the art of glass blowing got its start in America. In the museum's garden, colorful glass sculpture burst out from the ground among plants, flowers, and trees. The exhibition hall gallery showcased some of the most significant works by Dale Chihuly, a native of Washington State. The glass house is a centerpiece, focusing on Chihuly's lifelong appreciation of greenhouses.
And up above, you are looking at one of the largest suspended sculptures he's ever created. So there are over 1,000 Persians, that's what he calls the sculptures that you're looking at, suspended above our head in hues of orange and reds and yellows.
There's the Glass Forest Gallery, where visitors are blown away by a display of colors and lights. The Sea Life Room shows how the Pacific Ocean inspired Chihuly. Its 20-feet tall sculpture is a washed sea life. A car accident in the 1970s cost him his vision in one eye, but he continued to create works full of complex colors, details, and size.
I had no idea what I was going to see when I came in here, but they've incorporated so many beautiful colors and styles and designs.
We have pictures of Chihuly glass in gardens in our home, but they really don't do it justice. You really have to see it live and in person.
And to see everything's just a little bit different is so impressive. You wonder how he did this. I mean, it's just overwhelming almost.
Exhibitions worldwide shows Chihuly's art, but this museum serves as the only permanent home for his works. Valdia Baraputri, VOA News, Seattle.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll also find us each and every day on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. And you can hear us on great radio stations throughout Asia, like U Radio at Hatay University, FM 101.25 at Hatay University in Thailand. We say hello and thanks to everyone there who's tuned in to our program today. We also like to say thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Keith Lane. Thanks to Michelle Liu for getting us on Facebook today. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.